This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 133.
Then the second area where I see leaders stumble is that they kind of become a victim of their own success. Let's face it, like most of the people that I coach are individuals who have been highly successful for years and years and years, and they have a script for how they've been able to do that. And they have this unwillingness to let go of their script. They believe that if they keep doing things the way they've done them, that's what's going to lead them to this next level of effectiveness rather than adapting, rather than saying, hey, maybe I might be playing the same game, but I'm playing on a different field. And therefore, I need to change the way that I operate or adapt it or even have more range, right? It's not even about changing, it's about having more range. So I see them stumble around being so attached to their way that they don't then have enough flexibility or adaptability to meet the business or their team or the mandate or where it is.
How can you help leaders recognize and overcome their blind spots? What is a signature voice and why is it important in developing executive presence? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Imagine having direct access to 18 world-class thought leaders who will elevate and transform how you think about HR. As many of you know, late last year, I launched Elevate, a three-week virtual development experience that over 100 HR leaders attended and participants described as a master's degree in HR at a fraction of the cost and by far the most engaging learning experience in years. Elevate 2025 returns on May 20th, and it's specifically designed to elevate HR business partners and Center of Excellence professionals, strategic capabilities, and business impact. Who will you learn from at Elevate? We're talking Dave Ulrich on the next agenda for HR, Muriel Wilkins on breaking through limiting beliefs, Mark Efron on connecting talent philosophy to business strategy, plus sessions on AI-driven process redesign, agile HR, top team effectiveness, operating model transformation, how to communicate like an executive, what your CEO actually wants from HR, and how to get your expertise actually used. Every session is designed with the goal of helping you to take your business acumen, strategic thinking, influence, and coaching capabilities to the next level. Also, the 16 interactive sessions include live Q&A, where your specific challenges and questions get addressed by the experts themselves. And with recorded sessions and slides available afterwards, you don't have to worry about missing a session, or even better, you and your team can revisit these insights again and again. So what are you waiting for? Register now or learn more at www.elevate2025.vip/nextgenhr. Or go to futureofhr.com. But hurry, as early bird pricing is available for only a limited time. Don't miss this once-a-year chance to transform your capabilities and career at Elevate 2025. And with that, I'm excited to introduce this week's guest, Muriel Wilkins. Muriel is the CEO and founder of Paravis Partners and a sought-after C-suite advisor and executive coach with a 20-year track record of helping senior leaders take their performance to the next level. She's the co-author of Own the Room, Discover Your Signature Voice to Master Your Leadership Presence. But you might know Muriel as the host of the Harvard Business Review's award-winning podcast, Coaching Real Leaders, in which Muriel coaches leaders in real time and helps them to unlock their potential. And if you've not yet listened to Coaching Real Leaders or read Own the Room, I highly recommend both. Muriel's style is pragmatic and focused on delivering real-world outcomes. And that's a big reason why I asked her to be part of Elevate 2025, where she's going to go deep on the key concepts in her forthcoming book, Leadership Unblocked, break through the beliefs that limit your potential. And at Elevate and her new book, Leadership Unblocked, Marielle will discuss and share techniques on how to overcome internal barriers that are holding us back and how we can all unlock leadership success. This was a great conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it as much as I did, as Marielle and I discussed the biggest challenges highly successful executives face, including scaling their leadership and becoming victims of their own success, why understanding both context and desired outcomes is critical when coaching leaders, key insights from her book, Own the Room, and how developing a signature voice is essential for establishing your leadership presence, why leadership presence isn't an innate quality as many believe, but rather a skill that can be deliberately cultivated, and practical advice for HR leaders on building credibility and delivering tough feedback effectively to senior executives, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Marielle. Marielle, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm so glad to be here with you.
It's so exciting to have you on the podcast because I got to know you the way people sometimes get to know me, by listening to a podcast. And then I reached out to you and said, hey, you're awesome. I want to have you on the podcast. So it's great to bring this to fruition and see you here and have you on the pod.
Absolutely. And I was excited when you reached out because you had one of the most unique reach outs in terms of what you sent me. So I was delighted, and I had heard your podcast as well and loved what you were doing with HR folks. And so I was ready and willing to have this conversation.
Good. I have to go back and see what I actually sent you, but kind of going back to when you were 6 years old, you stood out because you actually started your first business at six, essentially creating a family bank. So have you always had this bug to be an entrepreneur and you're being your own boss? And just tell us more about how you transitioned that corporate world into really having an executive and coaching leadership development firm.
Sure, absolutely. And I can't believe you're bringing that story up, but here it is. When I was six, I didn't even know that that's what I was doing. And some call it a bank, some say, whereas the beginning of some type of Ponzi scheme or something, because I literally was picking up pennies that I would find on the street, on the carpet at my aunt's house, and I would put them in this little box. I don't know, JP, how I came up with this idea, but I basically started telling people, well, why don't you just let me hold your change in my little green box? And I'll save it for you, hoping that they would never ask for it back. Somebody one day was like, that's what happens with savings accounts. But these people might ask you for their money back. So I didn't quite have the full business model in mind, but certainly was thinking in creative ways. And I think to your question, have I always had this entrepreneurial thinking about me? And I think the answer is sort of, yes. Like I didn't quite know what I wanted to do when I grew up. But I knew that I wanted to run something. I wanted to own something. I wanted to lead something. And I also always had this kind of fascination with people and how they behaved. And so all of that blended together. Eventually, I ended up going the corporate route and getting my education in business and did the strategy consulting thing after business school and then got an executive role. And it was really in that role that I realized that there were some challenges to being in a leadership role. Wished that I had listened more in my leadership classes when I was in business school and sought out an executive coach and couldn't really find one at the time. This was like 20 something years ago. Couldn't find one that really had the strong business acumen that I needed from a coach, as well as the adult development side and the psychological side and all of those other pieces. That coincided with a specific moment in time where I was actually thinking about starting my own business. And so those two things intervened. And I had a mentor who said, look, you should go start your own business. And I had another mentor who said, you should just become an executive coach since you can't seem to find one that you like. And I merged those two interests. And that's how I ended up starting my own executive coaching firm 20 years ago.
I love that. So you basically couldn't find what you needed in the market. You're like, hey, actually, I think I could be that person for other people.
That's right.
And you went and did that. And that's great. And you haven't looked back. And the other thing that's really interesting when I looked back at your background is that you spent the first 18 years of your life living in North Africa, Europe, and the Caribbean before moving to the U.S. And I'm just curious how that international perspective really has shaped your approach to coaching.
So it's really interesting. I moved permanently to the U.S. when I was 18. I used to spend part of my summers here. So I'm originally from the Caribbean, from Haiti, to be exact. My dad had a job that had him working in different places of the world. At the time, it was in North Africa. I moved there when I was about 3 months old. It was this upbringing, JP, where I would spend 8 months of the year living this expat lifestyle in these foreign countries that I wasn't originally from, in these international schools with all types of kids from different professional who also families were expats. And then during the summer, I would spend half my summer in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, at my aunt's house, and the other half of the summer in my dad's village in Haiti, which was a very rural village 4 hours south of Port-au-Prince, with where at the time there was no running water, no electricity. And so I share that because I think it helps shape my perspectives that I bring to leadership coaching in a very specific way. I think number one, living in a country where it's not your home country or in a community that's not your home community, at least I took on the identity of being an observer. I became very astute at observing how others behave, what the culture is, how they act. And I became very curious about that. And that is certainly a part of what led me into coaching or what makes me, I think, who I am as a coach. I'm naturally curious about how people, how leaders particularly operate, what makes them tick, what makes one successful versus the other not successful. And that is really grounded in that piece of it. On the other hand, I think this ability of being able to go from one environment to another and having range, literally these expat communities and then being in this rural village in Haiti, allowed me to really see this notion of like, as people, we are same, same, and different. We're all the same, and yet we have differences. Being able to hold the complexity in that is a lot of times what I think leaders have to be able to do. And so I bring that to the coaching as well, being able to really sit down with anyone and just see them not only as a leader, but as a person. And how do I help them optimize who they are as an individual in that leadership role? And that really started, you know, I wouldn't have thought that it would have led me to where I am today, but I think those skills and more importantly, those interests were really grounded in that early experience.
Yeah. And it's an incredible experience you've had. And I love this being an observer, being curious, and the paradox of being the same and also being different, but it's hard to do. But what's really interesting is how your younger self and these life experiences have now really brought you to where you are at, which is really being one of premier coaches out there with your own podcast. You know,
you're too kind.
Having impact. You've got a book we'll talk about. You've got another book coming out. And so it's just great to kind of see that happen. But I think a lot of times as we're going through those experiences, we don't always know how it's going to help us 20 or 30 years later. And it's so interesting to see that come to fruition for you. But I did want to ask you and kind of get into coaching a little bit more. You've helped countless C-suite leaders reach new levels of effectiveness. What are some of the common barriers that you see holding back even the most highly successful executives?
As much as there are a ton of opportunities in being able to lead at that level, there's an equal amount of challenges, right? So I can't exhaust the whole list. But when I think about the ones that tend to stand in their way, even those who are deemed the most successful. And when I say stand in their way, what do I mean by that? I don't think as a coach, my role is to take away the challenges of my clients. I see my role as helping them get through those challenges or lead through those challenges with a little more ease, right? If they can do it with a bit more breathing space, if they can do it without causing any harm to themselves or to others, then job well done. And so what do I see as some of the main things that kind of get in the way of leaders, particularly senior leaders, being able to lead with more ease, with more efficiency, with more effectiveness? I think the first is an inability to lead at scale, right? And I know that that's a term that's used, maybe overly used. What do we even mean by that? And not being able to lead at scale is you are defaulting to the roles that you previously had and are unable to level up, not just in terms of how you think about the business challenges that are in front of you, but also how to manage and lead and operationalize whatever function or division or mandate that you have. What that looks like is you stay in the weeds. You can't delegate. You can't level up to questions. You're still the expert in the room rather than the facilitator. So this whole aspect of leading at scale, I think, is critical and not only gets in the way of the leader, but really gets in the way of the pipeline within the talent pipeline in the organizations and ultimately organizational results as well. Then the second area where I see a leader stumble is that they kind of become a victim of their own success. Let's face it, like most of the people that I coach are individuals who have been highly successful for years and years and years, and they have a script for how they've been able to do that. And they have this unwillingness to let go of their script. They believe that if they keep doing things the way they've done them, that's what's going to lead them to this next level of effectiveness rather than adapting, rather than saying, hey, maybe I might be playing the same game, but I'm playing on a different field. And therefore, I need to change the way that I operate or adapt it or even have more range, right? It's not even about changing, it's about having more range. So I see them stumble around being so attached to their way that they don't then have enough flexibility or adaptability to meet the business or their team or the mandate or where it is. Okay, so that's number two. And then I think the third piece that really kind of gets in their way is when they try to exact change or make results happen completely by focusing on external circumstances. So it's almost like, let me try to change everything around me so that I can feel more comfortable as a leader or so that things fit within the way that I believe they should be, rather than also addressing what's happening internally with them as a leader and asking, how do I need to change in order to be able to influence the context and be able to exact change in the system or in the context that I'm in? Not sound too cliche, but it's when the inner game and the outer game are completely out of alignment. And that can often be a stumbling block as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. And as you're talking through those three examples, context is so critical. The context of the role and how that role adds value. And are you thinking about the role the right way? Context of, well, I've been successful here, so I should be successful someplace else, but not understand that the context and the field has changed that you talked about. Or that last piece is really interesting, where the inner game and the outer game just doesn't make sense. And they're trying to sort of bend the universe to their will, right? Well, this is the way I want my reporting. This is how I operate. That organization may not. And it seems like a lot of leaders have that challenge with sort of getting understanding quickly of what the context is and what really matters. Mm-hmm. Are there ways, Muriel, where you help people think that through and assess the context?
Absolutely. I think that part of assessing the context is I always start with my clients from a place of outcomes. What is the outcome that you want as a leader for yourself, for your team, for your organization, whatever frame? And so then we look at it from that context. Which context are we talking about? If they can define what the outcomes are that they're looking to obtain, then we can work backwards and say, okay, well, if that's what you want to be true, what are the variables that need to either change or stay the same to increase the guarantee that that will be true? Because a lot of times that's not what they look at. Yes, this is what I want. But as you said, you know, I'm going to force it through this one variable, not paying attention to the rest. Okay. I'm going to change my tea. I'm going to wipe the slate clean and hire a bunch of new people, but I'm not managing them any differently. So is that really what's going to get me to the results that I want? It might not. Who knows? But maybe you ought to look at yourself as well. So the context is very important in terms of helping understand what are the conditions in the context that need to be aligned or at play in order for you to achieve the outcome that you want. And look, at the end of the day, as a coach, I just want my clients to be able to make a choice, to be able to make decisions around what levers they have that they can pull, rather than just being on autopilot and thinking that there is only one way to get to a certain result, or it has to be the habitual way or the default way that they've always done it.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. I think starting with those outcomes is critical so they have skin in the game. We also know sometimes there are executives where they know what the outcome is, but they still don't really get to action. You know, there's still like, there's how do we get that buy-in? I think a lot of HR leaders feel this way when they're trying to coach. They're frustrated because they have a good conversation. They feel like they got agreement or sign off. And then they go away and they come back and the leader didn't do what they said they're going to do. They really weren't really bought in. How do you get buy-in, or what are your tips around getting buy-in to get people to start taking those actions that they said they want to take? We all want to go lose weight and probably work out more and all those things, but we don't always do it, right? For lots of reasons. How do you do that in a coaching situation?
First of all, as a coach, right, you can't hold the accountability for your client, whether it's an internal client or an external client. You don't own the results. They own the results. When they talk about getting in shape as a coach, that's a big one, because you literally have to do work on yourself to say, I am supporting this individual, but I have to detach from the outcome. Because if you hold on to the outcome so much, you know, what you'll find yourself as a coach is you're doing the work for the client, which defeats the whole purpose. So the first is make sure that you are not holding accountability for it, that you are working with the client so that they understand what the accountability is. So this starts at the get-go. If you have somebody you're working with internally as an HR person and you're coaching them and they say, yep, these are the actions that I'm going to take, you should ask that person, what is going to get in the way of you taking those actions? Let's preempt it. Okay. What do you need to stay accountable to this? And let's set those things up. So you are also having a conversation about accountability. So that's number one. Number two, I think if they repeatedly don't follow through on the actions, then what you are doing as a coach is you're being a mirror. You're saying, okay, so this didn't happen, right? You said you were going to do X, you didn't do X. I'm just holding that up. What do you want to do? The choice is always theirs. But what you have to make very clear is the old adage that if you want different results, you're going to need to do something differently. So I always tell my clients that we can change one or two things. Either you change the result that you want and we start, keep things as is, or you change what you're doing so that you can get to a different result. Which one do you want to do? So you act as a mirror and reflect back to them. And at the end of the day, if they're not taking action, what you really want to boil it down to also is, why are they not taking action? Is it a matter of skill? They don't know how to take the action? Or is it a matter of will? They don't want to take the action. And sometimes it's both. And you can unpack that as well with them.
Yeah, I think it's so important the way you laid that out and so helpful for a lot of HR leaders, even coaches, because we sometimes can get in that accountability crutch where you're so invested, especially in HR leaders. We're like, hey, our job is to help get these results. We're supposed to support from the side, but it's difficult because not every leader wants to have that conversation when you hold the mirror up. But I think the way you framed it was great. Just kind of saying, hey, just kind of bring this up. We talked about doing it. We didn't do it. What do you want to do now? You know, we talked, is there a different path you want to take?
Yeah.
But not taking that ownership is a key message there. That
Yeah. You used the word framing. I do think that it's your job as a coach, as an HR individual, to frame it in a way that's relevant to the business person you're dealing with, right? Like, if they're not moving on it, framing it in a way that makes sense to them. And so unpacking that for yourself, am I framing this in a way that makes it relevant to them? And if not, then how could you, right? Is there another way? So when I work with clients, I might have to, it might be the same action that three of my clients need to take, but the way that I present it, the way that I frame it may look different from client to client.
Yeah, framing is really important. That is really helpful. I want to talk a little about your book now, Own the Room, Discover Your Signature Voice to Master Your Leadership Presence. And in that book, you talk about this idea of a signature voice. I would love if you could break that down and talk a little more about what that is and why that's so important to what you call leadership presence. Maybe people want to call executive presence. I like leadership presence better. But talk more about that signature voice.
So it's interesting. I think I'll just give you a little bit of backdrop as to why we even wrote a book on leadership presence and where this notion of signature voice came from. In my early days of coaching, we were getting so much feedback on our clients around they need to work on their leadership presence. They need to work on their presence. But when you ask people, well, what does that actually mean? They have no idea. They were like, I don't know. But, you know, if I see it, I'll know what it is. That doesn't help from a feedback standpoint. So I realized as a coach that I didn't quite know what it was. And so together with my co-author, Amy Sue, we set out on this quest to figure out what the heck people mean
when they say leadership presence. And what it really boiled down to, JPA, is it really was about how others experienced individuals when they felt like they were in the presence of a leader. So the question is, when you are in the presence of someone, do you feel like you're in the presence of a leader? And so when you dug a little deeper, I was like, what makes one feel like they're in the presence of a leader? Because what we quickly realized is it had nothing to do with where you hierarchically fell in the organization. We had been in rooms where the most junior person demonstrated leadership presence and the most senior person did not. But what it boiled down to is that those individuals who exhibited effective leadership presence really demonstrated two things. They demonstrated strong credibility and they demonstrated strong relatability. So credibility, they came off as knowing what they were talking about or being able to drive a vision, depending on what your sphere of influence was. Relatability was, you know, at an individual level, people didn't mind being around this person. And at a higher level, at scale, it was, even though this person might be the CEO, the rest of the organization still felt connected to that individual, okay? And that is all within a context, because what it means to demonstrate credibility and what it means to demonstrate relatability might mean different things situation to situation. And so those individuals were able to take both those variables and apply them in different situations. Hence why we came up with the term signature voice, because when you think about a signature, it makes an impression, and yet it is very unique to you. And so this wasn't about changing who you are or becoming somebody else, but really figuring out, with if you know that those are the two levers you're trying to pull, what do you have at your disposal to be able to do that in a way that still felt authentic to you?
Yeah, really helpful. And I love the idea of a signature voice, or the way you guys thought about that makes a lot of sense. And this idea of credibility and relatability, I think people kind of get that. Yeah, the credibility part is where people, I think, sometimes struggle for themselves, where they have imposter syndrome, they don't feel like they're credible, they don't feel like they know enough information. I hear that a lot from HR leaders, that they've got under the business well enough to speak up now, et cetera. And yet they should be really leaning into what they do know that maybe other leaders don't know. But maybe talk some more about some of the misconceptions and the challenges and how people can develop the credibility piece or even the relatability piece in a tactical way.
Probably the biggest myth and misconception around this notion of leadership presence is that you either have it or you don't. And one of the things that was very purposeful in not only writing the book, but even in the coaching was, no, this is actually something that you can develop. Just like if you were to develop finance skills or you were to develop influencing skills, that it wasn't just you're just born with it. Because again, I mean, that's so demoralizing. You give somebody feedback on something like this and say, but you know, guess what? You weren't born with the leadership presence gene, therefore you didn't. And I think we've been able to debunk that myth by providing a pathway for how you can build your leadership presence in a very practical way. And so the notion of thinking about how do you build credibility and relatability really has to operate at three different levels. At the most outer level, it's how you present yourself physically. And that's what most people tend to think about when they think about presence. But it doesn't stop there. And this is not to say that you have to dress a particular way or use certain gestures. You just need to ask yourself, if what I'm trying to do is show up in this particular meeting in a way that's credible and at the same time relatable, hey, where should I sit at the table? Should I sit way in the corner where nobody can see me? Or should I sit at the head of the table? Or should I sit on the side? What should I do? Should I even be in the room? That's a very practical question to ask. And yet it has a lot to do with what people will think or how they will experience you at the physical level. The next level is at the skill level, which usually has to do with communications. So we talked about framing before. You have to have the foundational skills, the communication skills that build relatability, or the skills of listening and asking questions. The communication skills that build credibility is your ability to send out a very structured communication. Are you able to speak in a clear, concise way? Those are skills that anyone can develop. They have to practice it. And then the skill of framing, which we talked about before. And then the deepest level is your mindset. So you talked about if someone has, you know, imposter syndrome where they don't think they have the knowledge. Well, that's all a mindset. That's all the knowledge. It's all the things that are internal to you. Is your mindset aligned with you being able to demonstrate value in that meeting? Is it aligned with you being able to connect with others in that meeting? What does that look like? Well, if I internally am having a dialogue that I don't really care what my colleagues think, guess what? I'm not going to show up as being able to relate to them because it is not going to result in me being able to listen and ask the questions. And again, all these things that thread the needle of making others feel like I am connected to them and relatable to them.
Yeah, a really helpful, great, great breakdown. I do recommend people go out and buy the book, read it. It's a great book. I have actually tried to find research on executive presence. I have read multiple books on this topic. Yours is the best. And I'm not saying that because you're here. I really, truly have read a lot. And there's not a lot of research on this. And it is something that is a little bit of a note when I see it, but I feel like your model is very pragmatic and makes sense. And I love the idea of the signature voice because there's certain state, really just misconceptions around what is executive presence look like. And I have to act a certain way and I can't be myself and I can't dress how I want to dress or whatever. And that's wrong, right? There's lots of good examples of that, but it's really stepping in that signature voice piece. And that's what I like about and what you guys talk about.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. And I do think there's been what I appreciate. I mean, we wrote the book over 10 years ago and there's been much more attention paid. And I'm glad there is around, again, the context, what we're expecting when we're using these terms. I do think that in the past, much of conversation around leadership presence was there was this one way of being or looking like, and that is not the case at all. It really is at the end of the day, here's the impact I'm trying to make. And there are all different ways of being able to make that impact. So, you know, it's like Skittles, choose your flavor of which way you want to be able to make that impact of credibility and relatability and helping individuals understand that they, again, have choice in how they do that.
This podcast is dedicated to helping HR leaders have more impact. And I know every HR leader really does want to position themselves better to be a credible coach to their leaders, and especially when they're younger or have maybe less industry knowledge. But how would you recommend, how can they position themselves more credibly? Are there any other tips we haven't thought about already? You know, how do you think about that? Especially in a situation where it's a power situation. It's not an executive coaching. You know, this person is your boss, if you will, or the person you're supporting. But how do you really come off as that credible coach?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I think that credibility is basically code word for earning trust. At the end of the day, it's going to be, think about when you deem somebody credible. It's like, can I trust what they're saying? Can I trust what they're going to do? Are they going to follow through? And so I think at a practical level, if you are particularly just establishing a relationship with a more senior colleague or somebody that you're supporting as an HR professional, you want to ask yourself, what is the quickest, most efficient, most effective, critical path to me earning trust by this individual? Okay. Knowing that there's no guarantee. There's always no guarantee. But you want to ask yourself that. And a lot of times it's no different than, you know, if you're new on a job, right? Like, what are the quick wins? What can I deliver on? And that might not look like the big, exciting, juicy, strategic coaching conversation. It might look like, I'm going to make your life a little bit easier at the beginning by making your performance management process this season a little bit more efficient than it has been for the past 3 years. Or I'm going to help you work through that performance management issue that you have so that it causes a little less stress than what it's been causing you for the past 9 months. Okay. So I do think that as somebody who not only has been a receiver of HR services as a former executive who works a lot with HR folks right now in my line of work, but who spends a lot of time tremendously supporting executives that I coach who work with our HR people, at the end of the day, the earning of the trust is, are you making their life a little bit easier? And that then gives you permission to kind of get into the bigger added value, strategic stuff that we all want to be, right? That strategic thought partner and coach and on the big topic. So number one, how do you earn the trust? I think number two,
learn what is relevant to them. And that is at two different levels. What are the critical issues that they're dealing with? What is keeping them up at night? And number two, how do they speak about it? How do you frame those issues? What language do they use? If you can approach whatever it is you're trying to coach them on with a direct path to what it is that's keeping them up at night, as well as using the language that they use. And what I mean by this is, look, when I talk to fellow coaches, I have a very different language than when I talk to my clients. This is why I went into coaching. I could not find coaches who spoke my language. I did not want to have to explain what ROI meant. I didn't want to have to explain what EBITDA meant. So be able to speak the language of your internal client and then frame whatever issues you're helping them solve in a way that's relevant for them. What's relevant for them? It's typically what is causing them heartburn and what is causing them to have this like never-ending hangnail. That would be my pieces of advice there.
It's great advice and really helpful to really have that kind of other thinking and get really in tune with your stakeholders, your business leaders you're working with. I think that is critical. Now, the last question I have for you, and I have to ask this question because I think it's an important question. So I think credibility is number one. That's the entry point. So let's just say you've got credibility and you have trust with a leader, but they have blind spots. You want to get some tough feedback. Something's happened. You want to hold the mirror up. What are some techniques and advice for HR leaders to give that tough feedback when they're always, of course, nervous that the messenger might be shot because they're giving this feedback that's difficult? How would you handle that?
Number one is, does your executive, the executive that you're supporting, do they see your role as one of being able to provide them with feedback? And so I would contract around that. Contract is a strong word, right? I would set expectations. Say, look, as my role as your HR business partner or as my role as your HR associate, you know, one of the things I can do for you is I can provide you feedback that others might not be willing to give you, right? I can be a ear on the ground without breaching confidentiality because obviously, you know, we have to maintain that, et cetera. But I'm happy to share with you my observations or what others are observing so that we can help you reach the goals that you have, JP. Does that work for you? There might be one or two who say no thank, right? But they'll at least try to be polite. And all you're looking is the door to open. So number one is set the expectation that that's part of your role. Don't just come in uninvited, all right? I don't want to go someplace and not get the food that I thought I was going to get. So tell them that that's part of the recipe. Number two is when you want to provide that feedback, if you're unsure, if you don't have that established relationship yet where it's part of the protocol, you ask for permission. You say, look, I have some feedback that I'd like to provide you. Would you like me to? Again, most times people will say yes, even if they don't want it. They will say yes, and it gives you the entry. Now you have to frame the feedback. It goes back to what we were just talking about. You have to frame it in a way that makes it relevant. You're not just throwing it at them just for the sake of giving them feedback. That is also important, is not just the ability to give it and the entry point, but then how you do it. And then I think that creates a certain level of discernment that you ought to have also as an HR person, is what is the type of feedback you're giving, right? Like, you want to make sure it's not just based on this one thing you heard walking by the hallway and you overheard. You don't want to do that. That's not good feedback hygiene. You want to make sure that it is grounded, that it reflects the values of how feedback is given in this organization. You want to make sure that the individual you're giving the feedback to is going to be able to handle the feedback, that you're not opening up a can of worms that then you can't close. What are you going to do once they receive the feedback? Are you ready to support them in terms of what they should do with it versus just throwing it at them and expecting them to figure it out on their own? So you want to think about it big picture and not just as this like one-off. And then the last thing I'll say, which really has nothing to do with the leader, but with more with you as the feedback giver, is if you are in a position as an HR person and you're coaching this executive and you're giving them feedback, just really double click on the feedback that you're giving, that it doesn't reflect any of your own biases. Because that's when we start getting into some danger zone and it becomes, you know, compounded bias over bias over bias, which can get really messy in an organization. So knowing your role and being in shape of why are you giving this feedback? Is it grounded? Is it not intertwined with my own story? Is this individual ready for it?
am I ready to support them? Do I have a recommendation as to what they do with that information? Thinking about it as an overall process that you are adding value and creating value rather than just one thing to check off my list. I need to give this executive this little piece of feedback.
Yeah, masterclass on giving feedback and good feedback hygiene. I love that. I think the underlying right is that feedback is, to your point, you need to be intentional and thoughtful because it's a high risk proposition depending on that relationship with that leader. And if they are listening to feedback, they're being vulnerable by taking that. And there's a responsibility, to your point, making sure that it's not biased, it's framed the right way, it's with positive intent, and you're there to help them maybe think through the actions they can take to act on the feedback. It's a really important piece, and it can really build a relationship, but also can break a relationship if it doesn't get the right way.
It makes me think about, I was Kim Scott's radical candor, right? And that has just created a buzz in a lot of organizations. We need to have radical candor. We need to have radical candor. And sometimes people aren't ready for radical candor. Like, get your executives in shape for radical candor. And so that's when we start talking about, okay, well, then what kind of feedback culture do we have? Is it an expectation of a leader to be able to receive feedback? Is that something that we are expecting of all of our leaders? And it becomes more of a culture rather than this one-off event or situation.
Really well said. Last question for you, Muriel. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
So it's a very aspirational for me. So I would say, if it weren't to me and I could wave my magic wand, the phrase that I would love to just permeate HR over the next 5 to 10 years is that of radical transformation. Transformation is an overused term. We hear it all the time. We want transformational organizations. We want organizational transformation. We want transformational leaders. Coaches call themselves transformational coaches. And the reason, as much as I hate overused words, I think the reason it's overused is nobody's really tapped into it. And I am adding radical on it is because maybe if we were really intentional around what it meant and strategic about what does it really take to transform, which is really about change. What would that require of us as HR people who work in the HR world? What would it require of our leaders? And what would it need to actually exact the level of change that we want in organizations? And it would potentially start addressing what I think is a really big missing piece of organizational change, which is that leaders at a cellular level are not changing themselves. It is impossible to change a culture, to change an organization, to transform a way of doing business if leaders are not themselves willing to look at what they're doing, the way they're behaving, the way they're thinking, the way they're approaching problems, and willing to make that change there. And so when I think about radical transformation, it's not just on the outer edges, but it is through the whole value chain, as we talk about in the old days. Credit is what is the level of transformation that needs to happen. And I fundamentally believe deep in my soul, and is the reason why I do this work, that the most critical aspect is for leadership to have the transformation in order for the rest of the organization to be able to transform itself as well as the industry and potentially the world.
I love that. Radical transformation. We have not heard that one on over 100 podcasts. So congratulations. And Muriel, thank you for being on the Future of HR podcast. This is a great conversation.
Thank you. I'd be happy to do it again anytime.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Muriel for sharing her insights on developing your signature voice and coaching leaders for success. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Lisa Chang, Executive Vice President and Chief People Officer for the Coca-Cola Company. In my conversation with Lisa, she shares why you need to be willing to ask for help, the role that she believes HR will play in the future, and why HR leaders need to continue to expect the unexpected and so much more. This is a great conversation with a great chief people officer and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.